Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 119 of VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so you don't miss a single episode. They come out each Monday and always feature big-name rock stars that found fame in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And today's episode features one of the great rock vocalists of our time. With record sales of over 80 million worldwide, six consecutive multi-platinum releases in America, plus solo success as well, I am of course talking about the brilliant former Foreigner lead singer, Lou Gramm. It was a great chance to talk with Lou because there's an awful lot going on with him and his old band, so you've got some great stories coming your way. First up, we'll hear about the recent stuff, so the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nomination, the news of Lou's new album to come later this year, and the fact that he's announced that this year will be his last year of touring. As well as all that, though, of course, we go back in time. We hear about his background, which meant a career in music was almost inevitable. The road crash, which led to him joining Foreigner. John Colodner's input, which helped the band get their first record deal. The backlash surrounding the Head Games album. His most difficult conversation when it came to letting Ian McDonald and Al Greenwood go from the band. We get into why Lou left Foreigner, why he believes his solo career was tanked, and what his relationship is like with Mick Jones after all these years. It's another fascinating interview, so without further ado, please enjoy this chat with Lou Gramm. Now, obviously, we've got to start with the big news and the fact that Foreigner have finally got the nomination to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I say finally because it's been such a long time that you've had to wait for this. Was it something that you thought was never going to happen?
I thought it was never going to happen. I saw our peers who were founded and started playing around the same time we did. Many of them got nominated and inducted already, and 10 years went by and we still didn't get nominated. So I was pretty much given up hope, was ready to write it off. So it was a huge surprise. I got my fingers crossed.
Yeah, and we all have indeed. You say it's a huge surprise. How did you find out that the band had finally been nominated?
Foreigner's manager gave me a call because we had been talking about that years ago, and he gave me a call and he said, "I just want to give you some good news that Foreigner's finally been nominated." He says, "That doesn't mean we're in." He says, "But it's a good sign."
Absolutely. And as we speak, the votes, because it's a public vote at the moment, it's very close at the top. I think Foreigner are still sitting in second, so it's looking good on that front. And you've got a lot of celebrity backers as well. Now, what did you make of that very funny Paul McCartney video that he released on Twitter or whatever it's called these days?
I was so surprised that he even would bother looking at those things, let alone keeping track. And it was a really nice, thoughtful thing to say.
And we're all waiting to see if you get in. And like you said, it's not for definite that you will get in, but to be nominated is fantastic. But have you spoken to Mick about the nomination and what would happen if you guys finally did get accepted?
I haven't spoken to Mick. I'm not sure if he's... what health situation he's in. I've spoken to, like I said, the manager, Phil Carson. I haven't talked to any of the other guys in Foreigner. Nobody's given me a call, but I'm sure that the calls will be coming, you know, sometime soon. I'm sure Mick and I will touch base also very soon.
Absolutely. And just talking about yourself, Lou, you've obviously been a very busy boy lately. You've been out on the road and you've publicly stated that this will be it. This year is your last year of touring. You've done enough.
I think so. Yeah. I've put in a number of decades, and while it's been fun, you got to be smart enough to see when it's time to stop.
And what is the reason for that? And why is it time now, do you think?
Well, for me, it's just I think traveling is such a hassle these days. You know, we don't do show after show. We do one or two shows a week, so we fly, and I don't have to tell you what flying these days is like.
What sort of stuff do you do? Is it a mix of Foreigner and your own solo stuff that you do?
Yes, it is. Yep, it's a good blend of songs from my two albums and the Shadow King album as well, and some of the big hits, some of the things I've been involved in writing with Mick. We do a bunch of the Foreigner songs too, and I've got to tell you that between the two musics, it brings the house down.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it does. And in terms of your voice, obviously, it's difficult when you get a little bit older. Voice changes, it drops and stuff. So do you have to change the key for certain songs, or do you still find you're able to hit what you could before?
You know what? I brought the songs down a half a step about 15 years ago, and I have no problem hitting it.
Oh, wow.
Yep, I'm in fantastic vocal shape, and my health is as good as it's been in a number of years.
That's great to hear, Lou. Great to hear. And you talk about your voice being in great shape, and you recently announced that you're going to have an album as well later this year. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's going to be a number of new songs. Some of the songs were from, when you record an album, and usually there's 10 songs on the album, but you usually record 13 or 14 and choose either the best 10 or the 10 that are finished. And so I've been doing that for my two solo albums and the Shadow King album, but there are always two or three songs that were really good ideas just without the time to finish them. So I went back and I dug up those ideas, and there's about three or four of them that I finished that are going to be on this album.
Fantastic. And in terms of
Yep.
newer material, are you writing yourself or do you write with
Oh
other
yeah.
people?
Oh well, I've been writing with a few other people, but I've been writing myself too, and there's a good selection of brand new, unheard of by the human ear songs, and it's been a fun album to put together. I didn't do it with any time schedule in mind, so it's taken a little over 2 years, but I got it the way I want it, and I'm pleased with the material and the performances. So that's worth waiting for, I think.
Absolutely. And how much longer do we have to wait before we can get to hear it?
I think there's supposed to be a single out possibly in July, and maybe by October the album will be out.
Fantastic. And who have you got working on that? What musicians have you got alongside you on there?
I've got my live band that's with me, the All Stars, who is Jeff Jacobs, who used to play with Foreigner, on keyboards. My brother Ben on drums. Scott Gilman on rhythm guitar and sax. He also played with Foreigner. Tony Franklin on
Yep.
bass,
The
and
fretless bass
Alex Gar
monster, yep.
yes, he, but he's a monster. And Alex Garcia on guitar.
Oh, fantastic stuff. And will you have a little tour after that towards the end of the year just to promote that record?
I think so, yeah. I think we're going to go till the end of the year. So I'm hoping that as soon as it comes out, we'll just slide three or four songs into the set,
Fantastic stuff. Well, so excited to hear this new record and see where it goes, Lou. But seeing as though we've got you here on VRP Rocks, we're going to chat about your life and your times as well. And we're going to start where I tend to do with a lot of people, because a lot of people got their introduction to music and rock and roll the same way. And it was a famous TV broadcast with some guys from Liverpool that came over. Now, is that the same for you, Lou? Did you watch that very famous show and decide that's what you wanted to be?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. I was playing drums already, though. Not a set of drums. I just had a snare drum. I was taking lessons. My mom and dad were both musicians. My dad played trumpet in high school, and after high school formed, this was in the mid to late 40s, so he formed a big band, big band with all the horns and stuff. And my mom auditioned as the singer, and she got the job. So they played 4 or 5 years around the Rochester, New York area, and they did well. And then they got married, and the little ones started coming, So my mom was out at that point, and my dad still played, although he wasn't in a big band anymore. He was in a five-piece combo. They were still playing around, and he had a job at a steel mill, and he had to be at work at 7 in the morning. So my mom would see him come in at 2 in the morning from his band show, sleep about 3.5 hours, and go to work for 10 hours. And my dad was dead tired. When he came home, he was dead tired. He'd be able to eat. He'd sit down on the couch. Within 5 minutes, he was asleep, completely gone, And my mom told him, "You can't go on like this. You better make a choice, either the family or your band." My dad put his horn away for 30 years.
Wow. So given your parents' background then, were they supportive of you going into music? Because obviously there was a two-headed beast of it, really, that they saw the benefits of it, but at the same time it was difficult to keep a family and a job and everything at the same time.
That's correct. They were pleased that I was so into music and that I wanted to excel at it, but they didn't like the fact that I was going to use that as my total means of making a living, because my mom had saw what my dad started to happen to him. And, you know, I heard that story a few times over the course of the years, and they wanted me to just keep music a hobby and enjoy it as a sideline, you know? And I didn't say I would or I wouldn't, but after I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan a couple of times, I was determined. Matter of fact, I was sitting there watching it with my two brothers and my mom and dad. And when they finished their first Ed Sullivan performance, I looked at both of my parents. I said, "That's what I want to do." And they looked at each other like, "Oh, no."
Oh, absolutely love it. And you mentioned there earlier that you were a drummer. So obviously you were playing drums. I think you were in a band called Black Sheep and things like that. And so how did you step out from behind the drums to being the lead man, to being the singer, to being the guy at the front?
Well, Black Sheep had two albums on Capitol Records. Before we got signed to Capitol Records, though, I was the drummer and the singer. And we were writing original songs. It was very difficult to put the theme of the song across to the audience when you're behind a big set of drums. They can't even see your face, you know? So we had a meeting and we said, either we need a drummer or a singer. And we tried to get singers. We auditioned a bunch of them and they didn't work out. A lot of them didn't want to do original material. They wanted to play the top 40 hits and make some money, you know? So I volunteered to get off the drums and be the singer, and we found a real good drummer. And we went on and we did two albums on Capitol Records. We had a hit single on Chrysalis Records. And we were supposed to be opening Kiss's special guest for a whole tour. And our first show with them was in Boston Academy of Music. And we got a standing ovation. We didn't know what to do with that. We looked around and we saw Kiss's tour manager, and he says, "Yeah, go ahead, play another song," you know. So we did, and that was so great. And then we went out and listened to them, and they were terrific. And then we drove home, and about 3 hours behind us was our crew with the truck and the equipment. I got home, I went to bed, and all of a sudden I got a phone call from one of the crew guys. He says, "Can you come and get us?" I says, "Dear God, what do you mean?" He says, "We hit a patch of ice on the New York State Thruway. The truck slid off the road and tipped over." I says, "Are you guys all right?" He says, "We've got some bumps and bruises, but we're okay. Thing is, we can't get the door open to see how the equipment made it." So a big wrecker took the truck off an exit and put it in a gas station in a little town, you know. And so me and the bass player went back and picked up the crew. Even though we couldn't check out the equipment, we picked up the crew and brought them back to Rochester, because that day coming up was Christmas. Yeah, the show we played was on Christmas Eve. So we wanted to make sure they were home with their families for Christmas at least. We weren't going to leave them stranded out there. And the next day after Christmas, two or three of us got in our band station wagon and drove back to the place where the truck was. And the guys in the gas station managed to jimmy rig the door up. And we all wanted to throw up. It was such a mess in there. The Hammond organ, the legs were ripped off. The Marshall amps, right through the hard shell cases, destroyed the speakers and the electronics. And even the drums, they were in hard shell cases too, but the cases were cracked and broken. And some of the drums had rolled out and they were not round anymore. They were oblong. And we got our insurance company to come and inspect the damages, and they reckoned 80 to 85% of the equipment was destroyed, not fixable. So the next thing I had to do right away, this is the day after Christmas, we did all this. I had to call 10 years after a tour manager. And, oh, sorry, Kiss's tour manager, not taking it, Kiss, because we were touring with Kiss. I had to call Kiss's tour manager and let them know that we wouldn't be able to do the rest of the tour with them as much as we wanted to. And he says, "Why don't you," you know, they were on Capitol Records, so he says, "Why don't you call Capitol and tell them what happened?" And he says, you guys got a new album out in Capitol. You're touring to promote the album. That's money for them, too. Have them front you some money against the album sales." And I says, you know, that's a good idea. I says, I'm going to call him right now. So I called Capital, and I'm not sure who I spoke to, but it was somebody in the hierarchy. And they said they would talk to a few other people and call me back. The next day they called me back and they said, we decided we're not going to do that. And we're giving you your release.
Wow.
How do you like that? Nothing we did, just fate. But with all the money they had, they couldn't afford to get us some used equipment and a small used truck and put us back on the road again to make us and them some money. Because the guys in KISS and the crew loved us, you know?
Yeah.
And it would have been a really good bill had we finished that tour. And that was the end of Black Sheep. And about 6 months later, Mick Jones called. He somehow called my father's number, my father and mother's number, and asked for me. And my dad called me in my apartment and said, this guy, Mick Jones, wants to talk to you. I says, Mick Jones. He says, yeah, I don't know who it is. He says, Mick Jones. He's got an English accent. He's from New York. He says, he wants to talk to you. So I called him back, and he told me he wasn't with Spooky Tooth anymore, that he was putting his own band together. And he happened to hear one of the Black Sheep albums and liked the way I sang and asked me if I would. He said, would you come down if we fly you down and put you up in a hotel? Would you come down and audition? And I says, well, I says, I would like to, Mick. I says, but I have to finish up business with Black Sheep. You know, we've got to figure out if we're going to try to continue or that's it. And he says, well, I'll call you back in a couple of weeks. I says, okay, good. So the next time the guys in Black Sheep and I got together, we get together once or twice a week just to see if we could do anything or, you know. Yeah. And so I told them about the call, and they said, well, what did you tell them? I said, I told them that I wouldn't come down because I'm already in a band, you know. And they said, Lou, you know, we sit here and we talk about what if and what if. They said, we all sit here and we know that this band is over. You've got an opportunity to do something and maybe something really great. He said, why don't you take him up on his offer and go see what you can do in New York?
Fantastic, and very magnanimous from the rest of your bandmates as well to allow that to happen. So just in terms of meeting up with Mick and the rest of the band then, what were your first impressions of him and playing with him and the rest of the band? What was your feeling immediately from doing that?
Well, I like them. They're all very friendly guys, and you could tell that there's a lot of camaraderie between them. Now, Foreigner, as we know it, wasn't completely together yet. Dennis wasn't in the band. And there was a different bass player too. So when we started writing, Mick and I started writing, the day I auditioned, he told me he liked the way I sang and stuff. And he says, you want to come over for supper tonight? He says, let's start writing some songs. So I went over his house. We wrote that night, the first night we got together, we wrote Long, Long Way From Home.
Oh, wow.
Yep. That's a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah, very good.
And so we would continue to do that every other night. And pretty soon we had about five or six songs. And Bud Prager, our manager, had the penthouse suite on top of a 20-story building in Manhattan. So he had all the offices around the outside, and the inside was just an empty space. And that's where we rehearsed. And after we worked up those five or six songs, we started, our manager started putting the word out that we are a band and we're looking for a record deal. And he sent out the rough tapes of our songs. And a little at a time, the record labels called our manager and came to see us rehearse. They wanted to see what we sounded like live. And I think there were about seven record companies that came and heard us. And they all passed on us.
Wow.
Yep. They all passed on us. And then Atlantic came. And Jerry Greenberg was the president at that time. And John Kolodna was the head of A&R. And So we played them some songs, and they had the demo of the songs, and they thanked us and they left, and we kind of looked at each other and we go, well, I don't think that's going to happen either. And then John Kalodner, about 15 minutes later, came back, and he says, I really want to talk to you guys. He says, I think your songs are great. He says, right down the line, every one of them is different from the other. They have a great style, a great cohesiveness, and they've got a uniqueness about them that is missing from a lot of bands that are out there today. Mm-hmm. He says, the problem is the demos and the songs you played live for us and probably everybody else averaged about between 6.5 and 8.5 minutes. He goes, you could never get that played on the radio. He says, let's get about 4 of the songs and trim them down to 3 minutes and 15, 3.5 minutes. So we'll cut out some fat. And we'll condense them into a very potent powerhouse songs. He says, and then let's have Jerry Greenberg back. And we're like, okay. So you know, all the big long overture songs that we were playing, you know, had 5 or 6 verses to them, you know. He cut it out, and we ended up having 2 or 3 verses and a guitar solo, and the song was over. You know, nothing was over 3.5 minutes, and that's just what FM and hit radio wanted. They didn't want anything over 3.5 minutes. They would either fade the song out in the middle, or they would not play it. And so, once we played the edited versions of the songs again for Jerry Greenberg, and he loved the other songs, he just didn't know what to do with them because they were too long. So he had a contract with them that day.
Oh wow!
So he pulled out the contract, and Bud Prager, our manager, called his attorney, and we did business that day. We signed a deal, and within two weeks, we were in the studio. Recording. We Atlantic Records had their own studio on Columbus Circle in New York City. And as we were going in to record at Atlantic Studios, Aretha Franklin was coming out. She had just finished her album.
Wow.
So she left some good vibes.
I bet indeed. And some sprinkled stardust as well on that first album, because it became an absolute global sensation, didn't it? It brought you guys such attention. What did you feel then? Because obviously you had success with Black Sheep in terms of the two records and touring with Kiss, and then you mentioned Make the Spooky Tooth and things like that. But this kind of took both of you onto a different level, didn't it?
It certainly did. Right from the get-go, it did. We could feel the impact of a real serious label behind us in their promotion department, in their distribution department. Their people were knocking on radio station doors and coming in with press photos and this and that, and the history of the people in the band. He would have like a 3-single EP.
Yep.
You know, and so the first 3 songs that got recorded were mixed and mastered right away and put on the EP so he could start playing them for radio stations. And there they were. It was Feels Like the First Time, Cold as Ice, and I think the third one was Long, Long Way from Home. Three really good songs. And seriously, I think 95% of the places that they brought the album immediately added it to their heavy rotation. And we were on our way.
Absolutely, on your way indeed. And just in terms of the songwriting then, just to go back to what you were saying about John Kalodner and trimming the fat and keeping it too radio friendly, is that something that you guys kept in mind for later in your career? So when you're writing songs for the next few years, or was that just for that first album?
No, always. We always kept that in mind. We would mention John, you know, and a lot of times he'd come in because he was with Atlantic Records for another 3 or 4 more, I think 3 or 4 albums more before he left for Geffen. And he would pop in from time to time, you know, and we'd play him a song and the song's playing and he's listening. And I'd see him look at his watch, you know, and the song ended. And I'd look at John. I go, "How do we do, John?" And he was like this.
Fantastic stuff, indeed. Just skipping on a couple of years, obviously into 1981, and an album that became absolutely massive again worldwide, the fourth album. And you're talking about some huge songs on there, "Jukebox Hero" and "Waiting for a Girl Like You" and all them sort of stuff. The album was number one in America for something like 10 weeks. And at that stage, though, Ian and Al had left before that. I mean, was it a worry when those guys had left the band, or was it something you kind of just knew that you were going to carry on and things were still going to be a success?
Well, the Head Games album had really good songs on it, and we thought we had the right producer in Roy Thomas, but he seemed very distracted, like his mind was someplace else. I think he had another album lined up to produce, and we didn't feel he was completely with us in our work, you know, and we expected that the Roy Thomas Baker sound and everything that would have went real good with the music we had. We also thought that he was going to help us finish some songs. We had great ideas on about four, maybe five songs, and we didn't have time to completely finish them because we had to get in the studio. So when it came time to work on those songs, you know, we were playing the songs and playing demos and stuff like that, waiting for Roy to say, "Well, why don't you do this? Why don't you end it like this?" And he would just sit there. And he'd be like this, you know. And Roy, what do you think? Yeah, it's good. It's good. Well, it needs a little something here. Any ideas? No, you guys take care of that, you know. And needless to say, we were disappointed. And the clock was ticking because we had to get the album out. So we finished the album, but I would say there's about three songs that could have been a lot better than what they were, but we just didn't have time to finish them. We ran out of time and we ran out of our budget. So we released the album and it did well, but it did less than half of what Double Vision did. Mm-hmm. You know, and it didn't get good reviews, because the album cover was a little suggestive, and the first single was "Dirty White Boy." And the second single was "Head Games." There started to be quite a few rock radio stations that refused to play it. And in my local paper in Rochester, there was a huge picture on the cover, front cover, showing a big bonfire and people throwing their Foreigner albums in it. We were stunned, and they were saying that our songs and our visual presentation of the cover was hideous and suggestive, particularly to younger teens and stuff like that. And what's the big station in Boston? Is it I can't remember what it is, but MMR in Cleveland, a lot of big stations in NEW in New York, they banned us. We got no airplay on a lot of the big stations. And the album, you know, after two singles, they called, the record company called us in and said, "We're up against a brick wall. We can't spend good money to get no results. Let's just pull back and work on another album." So we did, but the ideas we had for the new album were pretty different from what we had made to that point. And although the guys were good players, a lot of them were good in the one vein that we had been playing in. And when we tried to write new songs and kind of change our direction a little bit, they were still playing the same things they played for the last 6 years. And we couldn't get them to, I don't know if to open their mind or, you know, let their creativity take over. And Mick and I would after writing sessions and rehearsals and stuff, we would just meet and have a couple of drinks and talk about what are we going to do? We can't afford to have another album like Head Games, or we'll be looking for a label too, you know? So after, you know, we just decided to make that move, and we let go. Ian and Al, yes, that's right. And that was one of the worst moments of my life, because they were good friends and very good players, and they didn't see it coming either.
Was that something you did face to face? Was it a sit down conversation? Because sounds like it's a very, very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, it was very difficult to do, and we, you know, we were trying our best to tell them how we felt and what we needed, and they couldn't deliver. They would come up with things that almost sounded like two albums ago. So we were trying to move away from that, you know, keeping our foreigner sensibilities, but shifting the music to a different path, and they just couldn't follow us.
And then just moving on to your solo stuff then, because I think it was in about 1990, wasn't it, you decided to leave Foreigner. You'd had a solo record out before that. I mean, what was it that prompted your decision at that point to decide that it was time for you to go solo and to do your own thing?
Well, it was a couple of things. It was mostly because I didn't like the direction that the band had been going for the last couple of albums. Mick seemed to be incredibly enamored with all the new keyboards that had been coming out. And he heard all the great keyboard players, the rock keyboard players, using new sounds and stuff like that. And he went out and bought all the modern new keyboards and would stay up nights playing with the sounds. And thereby, the songs he wrote were keyboard songs, and we would learn them, and I would sing them, and this and that, and at the 11th hour, he would put a little guitar part on it, you know. But most of the album was based around keyboards, and I told him face to face. I says, we're going to lose our rock audience. He says, because although this has a rock beat and such and such, you know, being a keyboard song does not sit well with fans who began following Foreigner as a guitar driven rock band. Not only do they not care for the keyboards, but a lot of the keyboard songs were ballads. After we had the hit with Waiting for a Girl Like You, next album was I Want to Know What Love Is. Next album after that was I Don't Want to Live Without You. And those albums were laced with ballads or mid-tempo songs that could pass for ballads. And I started to dislike being involved in the band. You know, we would do live shows and we would start out with the first, second, and third albums and have the place rocking it, and 3/4 of the way through the set they'd be falling asleep, or you could sense the restlessness because they just weren't that interested, even though the songs were modest hits. That's not what the crowd came for. After one of the tours, Mick decided to take a break. He was frazzled. So he and his wife went for a worldwide cruise. It took over 6 months.
Wow.
Okay. And I can remember Dennis saying, you know, we should be working on a new album. What are we supposed to do while you take the cruise? And he says, relax. He says, just relax and enjoy yourselves. And I'm thinking to myself, I am going to enjoy myself. And all the songs that I had started to write or had written already, saving them up for a rainy day. And I'll give you an example. My bass player, Bruce Turgan, also played really good rhythm guitar. And he helped me with the chords on Midnight Blue. To get them to sound as good as they did. And while I had that earmarked for my solo album, Foreigner was getting ready to do an album. And I asked Bruce to come in with me. That's before Bruce was the bass player at Foreigner. I asked him to come in with me and help me play that song for Mick as an idea for the new album. So he had his acoustic guitar, he played the chords, and I sang a verse and a chorus, you know. And the rest of the guys in the band are going like this, you know. And Rick's going, oh, he goes, pretty good. He goes, let me see the guitar. And so Bruce gave him the guitar, and he tried to figure out the chords and the voicings. And you could see he was getting frustrated. And Bruce took the guitar and showed him the fingering and stuff like that. That didn't help the situation. That got him enraged. Somebody was showing him. And he goes, well, he says, it's pretty good. He says, let's forget that, though. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, let's forget that. And I says, okay. And so after whatever the Foreigner album was that came out after that, is when he took his cruise. And I had enough songs to do my own album. And I went to Atlantic with demos and told them that I wanted to do my own album. Mick was going to be gone for almost a year. I wanted to do my own album. These are the songs I plan on recording. Can you give me a budget and let me get started? And they did. And I did. And my album came out, and I was opening for Steve Miller on a tour.
Yeah.
Okay. After about the third week that I was on tour with Steve, after my set, I was in the dressing room, and somebody said, Lou, telephone call for you. And it was Mick. He goes, Lou, how's things? I says, things are great, Mick. How was your voyage? He says, it was great. He says, it was really, really restful. It did a lot. He says, but I'm all nerved up again. I says, why? He says, as soon as I go, he says, you go out and do your own thing. I says, I'm still a member of Foreigner. I says, I didn't want to sit around doing nothing. I had songs. I wanted to do them in a way that I saw fit and release them on Atlantic, our label, so that I, as a songwriter and an artist, could grow outside of Foreigner. I says, is that wrong? And he wouldn't answer me. He says, well, he says, if you want to be a part of this band, you better drop your part of the tour and come back. We're starting to record. So I did. And that was the album that I had little to no input in as a songwriter. That wasn't Agent Provocateur. That was Inside Information. If you look on the credits of the album, I think I'm in on about 2 or 3 out of 10 songs.
Lou, if I can just finish off with just your solo bits, if that's all right, just from
course.
Quick chat about that, because I really do appreciate your time. So obviously you had some huge hits on your own steam, the likes of Midnight Blue, as you mentioned, and just between you and me, both top 10 hits in America. I mean, you've been part of a big band for such a long time. So how was it having these hits under your own steam, under your own name then?
Very satisfying. Very satisfying. And I co-produced those too. And was a co-writer too. It felt just awesome to be able to do what I knew I could do for so many years and not having the opportunity to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure Atlantic gave me the support that I thought they should have.
Okay.
Because as soon as Midnight Blue broke into the top 5, I had friends in Atlantic Records, the offices there. And one of them called me and he says, I'm saying this under anonymity. He said, Mick just had a big meeting with Ahmet Ertegun. That's the chairman of Warner's. The gist of the meeting was that if Lou's solo album reaches a very popular stage, he'll never come back to Foreigner. That's what Mick told Amit. So suddenly, after Midnight Blue, the next song that came out was I can't remember what it was, but was Ready or Not. It was the title track. And it did okay. And then the third single disappeared after 2 weeks. They didn't promote it. They didn't promote it because Mick told them that he was sure I would come back to the band if the album didn't do well. But if it did really good, then I'd be gone forever. So after a big promotion on for Midnight Blue, suddenly there was less and less and less. And in 1997, I called Atlantic Records. I just wanted to see what the sales numbers were for the Ready or Not album. And they said it was 991,000 copies. Okay, so I was 9,000 away from being platinum.
Yep.
10 years later, I called again. It was 996,000. So in 10 years, it sold 5,000. And I said, I'm getting a pile of shit here. This is not right. So I didn't look anymore. I didn't ask anymore. I knew that I wasn't getting the truth for anybody.
That's incredibly difficult. So obviously you've spoken about being with Mick and things like that. I mean, how are things between the two of you in recent years? Have you spoken in the last few years at all, or has it been completely silence between you two for a long time?
It was silence after I left the band. And then when we got into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, when I saw him and he saw me, we hugged each other and so good to see you. It's been a long time, blah, 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 blah. We had lunch, stuff like that. And then we, you know, at the performance, we congratulated each other and this and that. And we performed a couple songs on stage with a backup group. And everything was nice. Then all the Atlantic people were there and we went over and took pictures with everybody. Yeah. From the office and all that stuff. It was all smiles and hugs and everything. And after that night, never heard from him again. Never heard from him again.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens if you do get into the Rock Hall and how all that goes down again then between everybody.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'll be friendly and cordial, but I'm not going to be like I found my long-lost brother or anything, you know?
That's a shame. I mean, obviously, you guys have had such success together. You shared such a long time together and everything that goes on with being in a band and being so close and under each other's feet for such a long time. That must be difficult looking back on all that and thinking how things
were. It's very difficult because we worked our tails off together, you know, writing most of those songs. And you know, I think we were the focal part of the band, too. So the live show was very important. And stuff, and I thought we had a very good friendship during most of those years, you know. But after that, I want to know what love thing happened. It was different. We barely spoke to each other on tour, even. You know, I knew that what he did to me, he was wrong and he was dishonest, you know. And he made a fortune and I made nothing. And got no credit from my peers or anybody, you know. It's that Mick Jones magic touch. Look, he did it again. I want to know what love is.
Difficult indeed. Well, Lou, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and I thank you so much for your time. If we can just finish quickly on the Lou Gramm Foundation, I mean, a not-for-profit organization, if you could just give us a little bit of information on that and what you guys do and how you help people with that foundation.
Well, what we do is we take letters or emails from young musicians who have the desire to play instruments and maybe can't afford an instrument or can't afford lessons to improve, and we get all the information and they send us a little tape of them playing and stuff like that, and we make sure that they're on the up and up through a number of sources. And if they need an instrument, we'll get them a used, but in good shape instrument and find lessons for them to improve themselves. You know, we'll pay the teacher ahead of time, and the instrument will be the kids. You know, you can't hang on to that, but it won't be a Stradivarius or anything. It'll be a good, workable, used instrument. You know, and then we ask them to send us something of them playing that instrument in about 6 or 8 months' time, and they do. So that's what we do. It's nothing we're doing where we expect to get something back. We're just giving in, and we've heard some really great things from some of these kids. We've been doing this about 3 years now, and we've heard some amazing stories about going from no instrument and unable to play to being first chair in the school band, you know.
That was fantastic. It must be great for you to give something back as well to the industry in which you've made your name and things like that.
So awesome. Yeah. My son Matthew thought up that concept, you know, and it's fun to be part of. And we you know, every night before the show, we have some of the kids who won and are taking lessons and have their own. We have them back in my dressing room, fantastic. And we talk about how things are going and stuff. And I sign a few things for them, and then they have their own seats and stuff out there. But it's nice just to keep your finger on what's going on with them. They're great, great, appreciative and hungry young kids.
Oh, fantastic stuff. And I urge everyone to check out the Lou Graham Foundation. There's a website and everything else, a Facebook page and that sort of thing. Check out everything that's going on with there, because it is a fantastic thing that you're doing. Lou, well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. And best of luck with the nomination for the Rock Hall. And I'm so looking forward to this new album as well. And fingers crossed.
It's on the way. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
There you go, the brilliant Lou Graham there, very open and honest. Make sure to check him out on tour this year if he's coming near you. It might be the last chance you get. Get voting for Foreigner for the Rock Hall if that's your thing, and look out for his new album to come later in the year as well. But that's it for this week's episode. Make sure to check out VRP Rocks Radio. The link is in the description. Give it a try. You won't regret it. Subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app. Check out VRP Rocks on YouTube and on social media channels too. And I'll catch you for next week's episode. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.